We also have some graduate students as well as undergraduate students. So we have a wide variety for you tonight, Jack.
Awesome.
And it will be exciting to hear your presentation. I think you'll see people that continue to pop in, but you can go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us all about you and what you do and everything you want to tell us.
Cool. All right. Well, a little bit about me. I suppose I could, Google Meet sometimes gets unhappy with backgrounds. Let's try something a little nicer than my green screen. Oh, look, I've got green hair. So I'm Jack Daniel. I am a displaced auto mechanic that stumbled into computers, networking in particular. If you did that back in the 90s, you learned about security, whether you wanted to or not. The Windows 98 NT Novell pre-IP days were interesting. We connected a bunch of stuff to the internet, and maybe we shouldn't have, which, you know, sounds a whole lot like a lot of operational technology, Internet of Things, industrial control, a lot of things that are connected to the internet these days that maybe shouldn't be. So we've come a long way, but I joined the vendor land 12, 14 years ago with a firewall company. I've been at Tenable for almost 10 years now. We do a lot more than just vulnerability management now, but that's what we're known for. In the greater hacker and cybersecurity world, I've been involved in a ton of conferences and user groups and community groups and community building. I'm one of the founders of Security B-Sides. Pretty much the only person at the global level who does administrative stuff to help support the community of hundreds of events around the world. Do a lot of that, and Tenable gives me time to do it, which is really cool. So anyway, that says I'm supposed to be in a meeting now. That's where I am. So that's kind of the short version. I joined Tenable as a product manager, and now I'm a community advocate, and that's not promoting the Tenable community. That's doing anything I can to strengthen the cybersecurity community, information security, the hacker community, those of us that there are more and more of us who straddle the world of DEF CON and things like that, as well as working in vendor space or working to secure things. So that's what I do. I have a couple other projects I might mention towards the end, but I've been at Tenable for a long time. The tool that the company was built on and that we built a company around is called Nessus. And let me, let's see, somewhere here there's a thing where I can start showing you some slides. I promise not to do PowerPoint to death, but rather than make you watch me let things download, we'll do a little bit of slides, and then we'll fire up the lab and see what we can find.
You should have a pop-up bar at the bottom that says present now.
Yep, there it is. Let me see if I can get this to go full screen.
Yep, that's good. Coming in.
All right. Now there's a question. I hate this. Are you seeing the full screen or the presenter view? Do I need to flip?
No, it looks good. It's full view. It's full screen. Yeah.
All right, cool. Good. So anyway, this is, come on, get past the boring bits. First, some words. One of the problems we have in the industry is terminology. It's been pointed out since the late 60s that we need common language to make sure we all are saying the same things. It's not unique to our industry, but it's a challenge that we've got. So I'll start with some really basic ones. The cybersecurity framework that came out of NIST and the MITRE ATT&CK framework are going a long way towards solving this problem for us in the industry. But some really basic words, threat, vulnerability, risk, and mitigation are keys to what we do at Tenable. So let's imagine that we're on the internet having a conversation, and we get into a discussion with someone on the internet. I'm sure most of you have seen this. If you haven't, the XKCD from many years ago. Are you coming to bed? I can't. This is important. Someone is wrong on the internet. So hopefully most of you have already learned not to get into internet arguments, but let's imagine that I choose to get into an internet argument and this young man disagrees with me and threatens to punch me. That's pretty straightforward. There's a threat. I'm going to hit you. That's pretty straightforward threat. This is obviously a gross oversimplification, but on the vulnerability side, people are squishy. I'm not young anymore. I reminded myself of that this weekend doing yard work. Eventually it'll stop hurting. I heal slowly. So there's vulnerabilities. We get into actual risk. And I was actually talking to the crew from CIRA today, the Society of Risk Analysts. Great group. If you really want to dig into what risk analysis looks like at the enterprise level, that's an amazing group. But here's the risk question. If this young man is on the other side of the world from me, the risk is not immediate. And what if I wanted to mitigate the risk? Well, I could lock the door. I would look silly in a football helmet on this presentation, but I could pad myself. I could protect myself. I could lock the door. Really gross oversimplification, but I like to use these to help define it. Now, unfortunately, thanks to the internet, internet attacks, network-based attacks, we are only a few hundred milliseconds from everyone on the planet, and that's a problem. That's why we have things like vulnerability detection. And again, gross simplification, we like to start with these two ideas that at its simplest, and these are ways to explain it to others too, if you grasp this. Vulnerability detection is like proofreading. Not really, but it is, in that you look at systems the way you would look at a paper, and there are some things that are just plain wrong. They're misspelled. They are improper usage, improper contractions, the punctuation wrong, things that just don't fit the rules. And that's sort of lines up with vulnerabilities, known weaknesses in systems. They could be misconfigurations. They could be systems that need to be patched because of known vulnerabilities. But there's another component of what we do and what happens, which is fuzzier. And that is policy and compliance stuff. And that's where we get into things like style, whether or not you use the Oxford comma, whether or not you hyphenate things, whether or not you use M dashes, things like that, those style kind of questions. It's like, well, this could be right or wrong. It's also whether you're speaking American English or British English, you know, do you have extra U's? So those kind of guides are what we work with. It's not a direct translation, but it does work. If you think about, there's some things that are just plain wrong, and some things are the way we want it in our company or our organization. We may use standards guides from NIST or GCHQ or some other body. We may take advice from SANS. The university may have some guidance that they have that comes out of Sirius. But a little history before we get cranking along. Back in 1995, Dan Farmer and Vitsa Venema released SATAN, the Security Administrator Tool for Analyzing Networks. First vuln scanner. Dan Farmer is a Purdue alumni. He was an early student of SPAFS in the Sirius program. And they released this tool, the first vulnerability scanner. And it scanned for weaknesses, known weaknesses that patches were available for. And that kind of kicked off a few people playing with the idea of finding tools to find weaknesses in a way that made it easy to figure out what was going on. 3 years later, a 17-year-old Parisian, a brilliant young man, Renaud Dureyson, created and released the Nessus Vulnerability Scanner. I believe it had 45 or so plugins at the time. Not a lot. I should remember that. That's like our introduction material, but anyway, that's that. Come back to me. Don't argue. In 1998, Renaud was recruited by Jack Hufford and Ron Gula. Ron had founded Network Security Wizards and created an IDS that went public or went commercial before anyone else, sold that to Cable and Wireless. Anyway, they spun up a new company, Serial Entrepreneurs. And they built it on the idea of doing vulnerability management, vulnerability detection. Critically, in 2011, they hired me. We'll go through this. Rather than make you watch me download things, we'll click through a bunch of these really fast. These slides are available if anybody wants to see them. It's pretty simple to walk through. But we have a whole line of products. Actually, let me back up one. Nessus, we have a free version, which we encourage you to play with. Download it, play with it. It's limited to 16 IPs. Doesn't do compliance checks. It is limited in some other ways, but it's completely free for you to use, to explore, to use in your home lab, in your home environment, to test your own machines, to use in an educational setting. Our commercial product, Nessus Professional, is really targeted at the consultant who visits different things. Tenable.io is a lot more than Nessus in cloud, but it is a cloud-based offering that's a blend of cloud-based and local installs. And then we have some large enterprise tools and a variety of other things. But focusing on the basics of Nessus, I did an install of Nessus Essentials. You can register for an activation code. We ask you continuously so that it's really easy if you skip a step. Register, download Nessus and install it. Currently supported a whole bunch of different platforms, Windows and Mac, of course, but a whole bunch of variations on the common Linux distributions, and we do still support FreeBSD. There is one footnote that's worth mentioning. Windows, the people at Microsoft have spent an enormous amount of effort since the past 18 or so years in really tightening up the security of Windows top to bottom. And there are still issues with it. They still pop up. But the network stack in particular has been tightened significantly. It is very hard to get Windows systems to accept malformed packets, and it's even harder to get them to create malformed packets and put them on the wire. As a result, you can certainly use this on a Windows machine, but you will find much better performance on scanning if you are running on something that's not Windows. If you like the Apple user experience, it scans very well. Same with any of the Linux ones. Because we do a lot of government stuff, which is a lot of Red Hat, I tend to use CentOS, but whatever works for you. Just a footnote, there's nothing wrong with using it on Windows, just know that it will take a little longer to do scans.
Why is that?
It is just as I said, Microsoft has spent so much effort making it hard to send and receive malformed packets on a Windows box that we have to do some tricks to make it drop malformed packets on. It's not simply opening up a promiscuous port and saying, hey, just do what we tell you, okay? Windows says, no, you can't do that, that's bad. And so there are some hoops required to get particularly a fully patched 64-bit Windows 10 box or current server implementations. They're designed for security. It works, it just takes longer. You'll probably find that even the most user-friendly of Linux distributions will do this for you. Also, it's worth noting that once you're installed, we do everything through the web interface. So even if you install it on something headless, once you've got it running, you can just manage it through the web interface, which we'll take a look at. So nothing against using it in Windows, other than it may take a little longer to run than some other ones. And it depends on the machines. Like the machine I'm on right now is 3 weeks old, and it's 10th, quad core 10th gen i7 with 32 gigs of RAM, and it doesn't slow down much. But anyway, it was worth mentioning. So of course we have a long convoluted license agreement. Download it. I always encourage people, no matter what you download, we give you MD5 and SHA-256, check it to make sure that it comes down clean. You should be able to rely on our web managers to keep it secure, but that also means that you didn't get a corrupted one. So anyway, there you go. Click through. You will get a self-signed certificate error, so you're going to have to click through that to get to that web interface. In this case, I installed Nessus Essentials, the free version. And so that's what I select, hit continue. Come on, there we go. Welcome. Once again, it gives you the choice to get an activation code. Just skip that if you've already done it. Plug in your activation code. And then this goes through a process, depending on the power of the machine and your network connectivity. We download all the plugins, which are currently over 100,000 plugins. And then we compile those plugins. So that first one, if you're not on a fat pipe with powerful computers, it might take you 30, 35 minutes to run through that. With Nessus Essentials, actually with any of these, it asks if you want to discover your network. It asks you where to start. In this case, I just said lab segment in my home network. And it automatically ran a discovery scan to see what machines it could find. There were fewer than 16 up at the time. So I just said, great, let's select them all. And that's enough death by PowerPoint. Let's see, am I, oh, it threw me out, all right.
So Jack, sure. Let me ask you a few questions. The way this is, you had on your own machine, I assume you had a bunch of virtual machines running concurrently, and then your own, I mean, you connected, I mean, how did you go to connect pretty much those? I mean, how did you scan those things? How much is going to be able to, I mean, installing 16 operating systems is not very difficult.
So actually this is part of my home network. My home network is highly transient because I build, well, not this year, but traditionally I build conference networks for hacker events for B-Sides, Vegas, and other things. And so that I also do some other things where I help people in need of, people in bad situations build them secure network systems. So there are a variety of things here, and some of it's actually what's always in my office. So this is just my home network, and you'll see in a moment what one segment of my home network is. For example, you won't see the security systems, you won't see the security cameras, you won't see some of the other IoT devices because I have them on a separate network segment. I have other things that are isolated in other ways. But this is actually just, you know, if you want to do it on your home network and you've got, you know, even just a few machines. In this case, one of the things that I forgot was on this segment is Sonos. And so it found the Sonos controller and subwoofer and other things. So it just scanned the local network that I was on. Now, in a lab environment, you'd probably want to set up a handful of virtual machines and do targeted scans. At home, you may want to do it and see if, you know, the NAS or other things that you've got at the house, your smart TVs, if they're plugged in, if those are actually secure and patched or if there are known vulnerabilities in them. So there are different ways to do it. There are, for virtual machines, you can grab VMs from various VM stores. And the thing to do is grab an older one that hasn't been fully updated. And instead of doing what they tell you, which is run, you know, whatever update process as soon as you install it, just leave it vulnerable, and you can see some of the things that have gone wrong, or some of the things that are incorrect. But you know, let's.
Can I mention something, Jack?
Really quickly? Absolutely.
As a student of Purdue University, all of you can download older operating systems from Microsoft. Okay, so install virtual machine, install old operating system, you know, an old Windows 7 or whatever it is, install all of those to be able to scan them. As Jack said, don't patch them so that they are vulnerabilities that you can find, okay? Tina, would you be able to assist students if they need to get access to the remote site, I mean, the MSDNA, I think it's called?
Yeah, well, no, now it's Azure. And the only problem is they don't usually keep the old operating systems too long because they don't want to support them. Microsoft doesn't want to support them. But I think you can get them for free elsewhere, to be honest, the older versions. Azure is the Microsoft platform for software, and they tend to keep that to the last version and one, maybe one before. That's about it.
Yeah, you used to be able to download from TechNet, and then that went away because of abuse, and then you were able to download from MSDN, but that's very expensive, and that's going away too. I'm trying to remember what it's the there is.
Yeah, because we went from MSDNA to Imagine, and now it's Azure DevTools for Teaching.
Right.
And and everyone has access, or all student IT students have access to that. But like I said, they usually only maintain maybe one older version of things before they, because like, you know, for Visio, I have 2016 and 19, but for the operating systems, I don't think they go much before 10. I'd have to check.
Yeah. Yeah. You may be able to find some, there's, I don't know if you can find a virtual machine, but you can probably find the ISO of, I feel bad saying this because it's completely doing it the wrong way. There is a really great security tool suite called Security Onion. It's a Linux distribution with a whole bunch of open source tools, pre-compiled with a bunch of scripts that make it really easy to run them. It's really easy to get overwhelmed by it, but you can take that Security Onion, install it, and it says everywhere update continuously. And what you can do is run a bunch of scripts to launch a bunch of tools, and it will come back with a whole bunch of vulnerabilities. And I feel guilty saying that because they make it really clear never to do this. But you'll find that. You may also find there was something called Damn Vulnerable Linux. It's been discontinued, but if you can find a copy of that, the OWASP project has Damn Vulnerable Web App, which won't do as much here unless you're doing web application work. But if you can find, you know, older Linux distributions, you know, go to Debian, and they keep some of the older ones out there. If you download an older version, a virtual machine of something, you can probably find them. Also, if you're using a virtual machine or a VM library somewhere, like from one of the virtualization players, if they've got their libraries or stores, you may be able to find some stuff that's out of date. You're going to have to dig a little bit for it. But honestly, the other thing is, you know, you'll learn a lot even without something that's horribly vulnerable. But so let's...
We're hoping to help out some small businesses and nonprofits in the near future, and they may naturally have those operating systems. Yep. So we may not have to simulate that.
Yeah, well, small businesses, it's gotten better in the past few years, but one of the places to always look is at their credit card point of sale systems. They're notoriously connected to the internet with RDP open on the default port 3389, often with credentials that are installed by the managed service providers, which are not unique. They're not necessarily default, but there are a bunch of common ones that you'll find. The other thing is that if it's not a current version of Windows, if it doesn't have the latest RDP security features, there are some ugly bugs for RDP out there, and those should pop up. And those are ones that you really want people to fix. For many years, there were Eastern European crime gangs that made a lot of money off of just those point of sale systems. So let's dig into this, that scan I did on that day. It found 14 hosts, and this network's always in transit. Doesn't tell you a whole lot other than it's pinged the host, found a machine. So if we go back, this dashboard would have just come up with just host discovery. So I did a basic network scan, but let's show this. We're looking at this. If you click new scan, once you're in here, we have all of these templates. This first one, discovery, host discovery, is what it runs by default when you first launch it, and you can run again. And that just finds machines on the network.
Jack, I don't think you're sharing your slide right now. You started sharing the last PDF, PowerPoint.
Okay, all right, let's see. Stop sharing. Now, that's right, here we go. Turn on, did I present now? This is gonna be a little weird until I flip back. Let's see, now, there we go. You should see the Nessus window now.
Perfect.
Right, I forget. Google Meet is, they're all slightly different. Anyway, so this is what you see in, we have a bunch of pre-configured things and our teams do things to make it easier. So mobile devices aren't on the free version, nor is the configuration stuff on the free version. There's audit your cloud infrastructure, there's PCI scanning, mobile device management, offline configuration. If you're doing a lot of network stuff, you can actually download your configurations from your Cisco or other network gear and Nessus will scan it without even touching the machine. Variety of other things, but so that when we run into things that are common problems or big ugly things, bad lock, shell shock, drown, we'll create a scan that does that quickly without doing a lot of excess stuff. So ransomware checks, other things. The host discovery is what we ran. I'll show you that in a minute. Basic network scan, I ran a couple of those. And then you can do them full custom. You can also scan for malware. This is not as effective as running anti-malware or malware scanners on the local machine, but you can scan your network and see if anybody responds in a way that looks like they're compromised. It's another good way to feel a little bit more comfortable about life. So let's look at some of the results. That first host discovery scan really doesn't show you much. Gives you IP addresses, tells you what ports are open out of a basic range. but basically just tries to find some machines. Then you can use that. So one of the basic network scans, this was, let's see which one looks the most exciting, basic network scan. So when we look at this, it shows you the list of hosts, or you can look at it by vulnerabilities, and you can see how many times it's been run. So the original one that I ran found 48 vulnerabilities. The provided three remediations, and this is one of the things that we do well, which is, you know, just do this on one host and you're gonna fix a couple of vulnerabilities. Obviously, this is a small sample, but we try to make it easy for you to fix the things, to find the things that are gonna give you the most value. So here we go, we can drill into any of these. So this one, there are a couple of different drop bear issues depending on the version, but we're gonna tell you just update to the latest. So we're gonna go back to vulnerabilities. This one's is a Ripple vulnerability. This host happens to be a ancient HP printer. And so I'm not surprised that that's vulnerable. This is not bad with just 14 devices, but there's a lot of stuff. And this is very, you know, I don't know how interesting it is to you. And if you're a typical administrator and you're overwhelmed, this might be interesting, but so for example, SMB V1 shouldn't be enabled anymore. Those days are gone, but in the real world, we don't have time to deal with all of that. So if I were to come here and just say, I don't have the time, there are a bunch of different filters available, but don't show me anything that's informational. And so now I've got, oh, all right, that's easier. Let's, you know, just for fun, all of the following, let's add another one. Let's say I don't even care about the lows. Let's do this. Equal to critical. Just show me the criticals, okay? I can't fix everything. There we go. Here are the two worst things. And the way we define these is, it's in here and there's always a little extra information, almost always. Of course, link rot is universal across the internet, so we'll skip that. But a format string flaw exists due to improper handling. Flaw exists, a series of flaws according to the banner without doing destructive stuff. And so this is giving us that. What version is installed and what version it's fixed. So this is an older one. This was fixed 4 years ago. Back to the vulnerabilities, back to scans. I've done some other things. If you're just trying to see what's running in your network, we've got some machines here. These aren't really vulnerabilities, but service detections. It's found web servers. This kind of thing can be a very quick scan. And what are all these web servers doing on 1400? In your environments, in your sensitive environments, these are important questions to ask. So there's a non-unencrypted one, and that's an old power distribution unit. That's a web-managed PDU, so I don't have to walk across the office to reboot servers in the lab. When I lived up north, they were in the basement. My office was on the second floor, so that's my. But because I know what these are actually Sonos systems, and they all run, those speakers all have web servers running on multiple ports. So when you're thinking about devices in the environment and people complain about you shouldn't have consumer gear in the office, especially in a secure environment. Wow, there are a bunch of web servers. If we were to take the next step and scan them, I guarantee you they're not fully up to date because Sonos is a commodity, you know, is a music hardware provider. Let's take a look at a couple of more interesting ones. This is one, I had a friend several years ago who was dealing with a bunch of compromised hosts, and he wanted to figure out what the common things were. So we did some scans and sent me data of live things. We're being in the US and working for a vendor, port scanning, we generally assume is legal. Some places don't. That's for your lawyers. My general advice is don't scan things that you don't have permission to scan, even simple scans. This was someone not in the United States or even in Western Europe who did these scans, but then he shared it with me, so I'll share these with you. So these were all systems that were being used to send spam. And a couple of these, like, I don't know how they got that one. Maybe there was a common credential. But when you see something like this one that had multiple SSL issues, multiple PHP, multiple MySQL issues, the Apache was out of date. Without doing forensics, there's no way to tell how they compromised that machine. But it's absolutely no surprise that somebody scanned this thing on the internet, found it was vulnerable, and installed their software on it. I don't even know where VN is, but this one, RPC, remote procedure call, OpenSSL, another Apache. So these kind of things, when you see these in your environment, you need to like drop everything and fix them. But let's get back to the scans. This is kind of boring. One of the other things that you can do, even if you just install this on one machine and scan the machine itself, this is one of my servers that I scanned itself, and I had some local security check failures, and it just said it was out of date. And this happens to be an ancient version of Red Hat that I was running at the time. So there's a good way to get some vulnerabilities. And again, there's a bunch of stuff, and the filters. You can specify whatever you want. So in your environments, you'll have your own policies on how you find things and how you prioritize them. We try to do a good job with our severity ratings, but there may be a CVSS score. There may be a specific CVE that you're looking for. We give you a lot of choices for how to do that. But that's a quick overview. My scans, to start a new scan, to create a new scan. One of the things that we do two types of web application scanning. These are some pretty basic ones. They can take a while. We have a web application tool that's a really solid one, but that's commercial. And honestly, it's not expensive for what it does, but it's not free. Another one that's worth mentioning, and it'll take a little bit of reading to get these to work right, is the credentialed patch scan. And in this set, in this scenario, you provide credentials to us. We keep them encrypted. They're passed, hopefully encrypted on the network. You can control that in the settings here. We'll show you. But you actually log into the remote devices. So instead of making assumptions based on banners and what comes back, we'll actually log into a Windows machine and crawl the registry. We'll actually log into Linux and BSD machines or Mac machines, log in, we will crawl through them, we'll run a series of scripts and commands to see what's current in them, what's not. We'll look for installed packages and software, we'll compare those versions, and it's a lot more accurate. Now, getting credentials can be political inside an organization. For your own labs, it's easy enough to provide them. You may have to jump through some hoops to get them to fly through your network, but it's going to ask you some questions like, you know, using SNMP SSH, you can do public key, you can do by certificate, you can do password, you can do combinations of things to add that. You can elevate privileges if you need to do, like against network hardware, you can do Cisco enable, you can do an SU plus sudo. How, there are a variety of different options for logging in via SSH. Windows, you can use password. And then this is, you'll note by default, we never send credentials in the clear and we don't use NTLM V1. These are a bad idea. If the remote registry is not running, we'll need you to start that to really crawl through that Windows machine. And the same for administrative shares, but these are going to get into corporate policy. And we can do this with LANMAN hashes or NTLM hashes or Kerberos. Anyway, so there's a quick look at it. Back to scan templates. Oh, look, it's mad at me. And so we let you really drill in, but it'd be a little overwhelming to dig into the crazy stuff that we can do. So let's jump back to, let's get back to present window that. I've got a couple of the last few slides once this comes back up. We back up there? Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And just to walk through a little bit more, if you got questions, actually, I put this in the wrong place. I'm going to show you a couple more things. If you're curious about this, community.tenable.com, great place. You can sign up for a free account, ask questions. A lot of people have answered really common things. Right there, I was just talking about logging into your Cisco gear. There's somebody trying to log into Aruba Networks. Specific questions about a variety of things. A lot of folks from Tenable are in there. That's one source. If you are interested, Tenable University, we have a bunch of free training. We also have commercial stuff. But we have a ton of free training at Tenable University. You do have to sign up for a free account. For example, this is a couple of these. Nessus Manager is a different animal these days. But Nessus Scanning, Nessus Compliance, Analysis and Reporting, but like Nessus Scanning, basic stuff, Nessus Deployment. There's some basic stuff here, and as well as all of our other product line is out there, but it's a bunch of free training. You can get in way over your head if you're not really using it on a daily basis, but deployment and scanning and analysis and reporting might be interesting to you to make sense out of them. The reports I didn't dig into because I don't have good stuff on that one, but you can download the reports as HTML. You can look at them on screen as I showed you. You can pull things out as in a variety of formats. Our files are XML, like everybody makes things XML. So at some point, a lot of people get, if you're used to dealing with XML parsing, a lot of people just grab the data and work on it with their own tools. Go ahead.
Jack, what training, Arthur, can you go back to the previous slide, please?
Yep.
Which one would be the first class that one of my students should take to just get a good idea about how to use the Nessus tool and, you know, be able to scan their home network?
The Nessus scanning one. The deployment, for the most part, on a single machine, you're just going to install, run it, and get it running. That's more about distributed deployment is where that gets interesting. But Nessus scanning is just the basics of running scans. And from there, analysis and reporting, if you want to drill into what it's telling you, and then Nessus advanced scanning, and you'll notice that each of those is only a 1 hour session. Nessus scanning is 1 hour approximately. Nessus analysis and reporting is 1 hour. And then Nessus advanced scanning, which is where you start doing more custom stuff, where you start selecting specific plugin families and ignoring other plugin families. And there are a couple of reasons to do that. Often around trying to get the best results in the shortest amount of time. There's no point in letting us determine what operating system something's running if you're scanning, say, a lab that's nothing but Red Hat servers, then you would only use that family, for example. But those three are each 1 hour each. And, you know, those are all things that you can play with using that free version of Nessus too. Things like the compliance and web application stuff aren't going to be as useful to you since that doesn't apply. But really start with Nessus scanning, then Nessus analysis and reporting, and then Nessus advanced if you wanted to dig a little bit deeper. And, you know, the sales team gets upset when I say this, but we're not the only company that does this. There are three primary players. One is primarily cloud-based. that's Qualys. The other one is Rapid7. They have a diverse portfolio. All three of our companies compete. We're all three publicly traded. The sales teams aren't, but as is common in competition, there are a lot of us who are friends. The Rapid7 crew and past, present, and future Tenable folks on the technical side, we're friends. So I will say that, you know, particularly with Rapid7, they've got some free tools that are good for learning. I have been at Tenable for a decade, and I think that we do what we do better than anyone else. But obviously, I'm biased. I've been getting paychecks for a decade. So yeah, Rapid7 is also the keepers of the Metasploit project, the exploitation framework. And so that's a much more advanced kind of thing than just scanning with Nessus, but that's, there are other things out there there, and they're very different, but the fundamentals of scanning a network, figuring out what you've been told in the report and figuring out how to drill in more accurately with more targeted scanning, is going to serve you well, whether you're, using, the free version of Nessus or you're using our enterprise tools. Or, you know, if you land somewhere that doesn't make our sales team happy, that's fine. You're still going to learn something from these ideas.
And I can tell you that if you work with Tenable, Nessus is the tool to know. The other two tools, you know, we don't use them. So use, you can learn to run an AKS scan and then look at the remediation steps and then go to your OS and remediate this. Something that would be excellent for you guys to learn, okay? If you learn to scan a machine, see the vulnerabilities, and then you go and fix them, then you run another scan and you see that everything is good, pretty much you know that, I mean, you have some very useful skills. Okay, I'm not kidding with that. And then again, try your vulnerabilities and start it again, or put another OS, play with new types of OS.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a real environment, one of the things to be aware of is that you're going to find a lot of vulnerabilities. And keeping history, this, what Nessus does is pretty simple. When you get into Tenable.io or our on-prem enterprise solution, which used to be called Security Center, is now just SC or Lumen, these things, the important thing is to look at over time. If you walk in to an environment and you're given a job and you run scans, whether it's with Nessus or if it's one of the other tools, one of ours or somebody else's, and you find 200,000 vulnerabilities, that may or may not mean anything. If a year ago they had 1 million and now they're at 200,000, that's really solid progress. You would like to get it much closer, but with vulnerabilities being reported, patches being rolled out continuously, with, you know, for example, Oracle pushes out hundreds of patches every quarter, it's hard to stay on top, and you can't patch a lot of things as fast as you would like to. You know, there are certainly ways to move that forward, cloud-based technologies and things where you can transfer workloads, make it easier, but the fundamentals of finding stuff that's not right and fixing it and having the history of saying it was broken, you know, it was vulnerable before, it's not now, is progress. It's provable progress.
And this brings a very interesting point. Thank you, Jack, for saying that, is that if you don't use consistent images, you know, you try to repatch your system from the get-go and you don't have, you know, a ghost image or whatever it is to just deploy the same consistent image again and again, you're going to have different vulnerabilities on different machines. This is not good. This is bad. So try to be consistent with your with what you install on your system, so that, you know, all of your Windows 10 machines look the same. Otherwise, it's not good.
Very real, absolutely. You often find that in well locked down environments, there are a couple of different. There may be, you know, 2, 3, 5 different images that depend on the job role. So in corporate America, you may have people in the creative teams and marketing who have a bunch of Adobe tools. You may have people in sales enablement who have a bunch of data management tools. You may have people in your labs that are doing research that have a bunch of data management tools. But you have a base image that's, you know, 90% the same, and there are a couple of different variations. And the tighter you keep those, the better, you know. And sometimes there's weird stuff that happens. Windows 10 has largely addressed this, but one of the ones that Microsoft was problematic with forever was that to install fonts, you need administrative access, local admin. And the people that are playing with fonts and finding cool fonts for your web properties, for your print material, the people in the marketing department that bring the money into the company that get the attraction or bring the students in or bring the donor dollars in, aren't always as concerned about where they download a font. If wherever you've got your license doesn't have it, they're like, I can grab it from something that looks like Font Diner but is misspelled, and the next thing you know, there's bad stuff, and you have to give them administrative rights up until Windows 7. You had to make them a local admin to be able to install that. So there are these weird little edge cases, like why do they need local admin? It's because they need to install fonts. So there are things that you learn about the oddities, but yeah, keep an eye on it. So anyway, where are we doing on time? I am
1 minute.
Yeah, I'm readily available, JDaniel at Tenable. If you're on Twitter, I'm sorry, it's a nightmare. I'm mostly ranting and political and giving friends hugs and virtually, but I'm on Twitter. Couple of things that I, you know, shameless self-promotion. Security B-Sides conferences, they're starting to happen again. There have been a lot of virtual ones. If you go to securitybsides.org, on the top of the wiki, I keep a list of virtual events. If you want to see some content online, there are a handful coming up and you can attend virtually. Tokyo last month had a small in-person event, and there's one in Australia coming up in a few weeks that they're probably going to do in person. So the world is returning. B-Sides events, we pride ourselves on being approachable, welcoming to new people as well as experts. We often do a lot with career development and new speaker development. B-Sides Las Vegas does, as does some of the others. Vegas, I have a lot to do with. We do a new speaker development track. If you get accepted, you do a short talk, you get a mentor. They work you through giving your first conference talk. We record it. We encourage you, and you can get experience doing that. If you're really interested in the industry, right now we're digging hard into cloud. I'm on a podcast I started a year ago with my former boss and a good friend of mine, Security Voices. It's kind of inside baseball for most folks. We talk about venture capital and state of public cloud right now. And one that I'll actually be speaking to another group at Purdue in February or March. I'll be talking to some of the folks at Sirius about the Shoulders of InfoSec, which is a project that I started almost, I don't guess, 8 years ago, looking at some of the historical figures in the industry and their stories. And Eugene Spafford was instrumental. He was an incredible help in researching that and encouraging me to do it. And so that is, it's an ugly wiki that has a lot of information about some of the historical figures, and it's got some interesting stories. And I've done a variety of presentations on that. And just, you know, the people that came before us, they were real people. That's my main thing. They were actual people. There were some cool folks. There were also some interesting criminals. That's that. And I'll throw this slide up. I realize that I should never end by saying something's the end. It's the beginning. Hopefully you've learned something, and this is a starting point for that and whatever happens for the rest of your evening. And since we've got a few minutes, I'm happy to field any questions. I'll go back to camera and we can...
Yeah, the chat, it was active. There was some comments there. I don't know if you saw all of that, but folks are following along with you. I'm definitely going to share all of your links, by the way, awesome links. And thank you for mentioning Sirius and Spafford. I have met
he's become a dear friend, even though I'm not an academic. I dropped out. Like I said, I've fumbled into this.
Yeah, he's a great character. I put the links in there because not everyone is quite aware of him. You know, I think you know Purdue Global and Purdue University West Lafayette, all the different campuses are kind of all their own stuff. So
there's in the next room, there is a Spaff bobblehead standing next to the bobblehead of me.
So awesome. Yes.
He and I started a gathering like 10 years ago during RSA, which we now call a Curmudgeon Con. And we would meet right down the street from the RSA conference, and it was Spaff and I, and then others joined us, Gene Schultz and Becky Bass, who unfortunately we've lost, but some other folks, folks that I think of as the young ones in the industry, like Chensi Wang, are now part of our crew, and Wendy Nather. So he's a treasure.
Great.
Anyway, so yeah, and if you would like, I'd be happy to send you a PDF of the slide deck, and you can share that with anybody that wants it.
Yeah, that would be helpful too. Yeah, I know some people popped in later, and I definitely can share that.
And it's jdaniel@tenable.com. I have now been pushed into a role which is completely non-technical officially. So I have no answers to anything, but I can find the right people to answer almost anything.
I think it was interesting just from the very beginning of your presentation. I was thinking about it's just one more career path for cybersecurity students and graduates at some point in your life. If you want to move to academia, you can. If you want to move to sales, if you want to do product management, I mean, there's so many different.
So I didn't plan on going to product management. I was at a company where I ended up doing a lot of community building. I've done a ton of community building. I had no budget as a former mechanic. I had no budget. So the user groups in the greater Boston and Providence area were where I learned from people who shared with me. And I felt that I owed it to them to share back with them when I learned stuff the hard way, usually at 2 a.m. with NT4 or Exchange 5 or 5.5. And then, the communities kept building, and I was an active part of that. But I've done, I was on the board and an active member of blacksmith ornamental ironwork guild for almost a decade in New England. I'm just a serial volunteer and a serial community builder. So when we sort of had this idea to throw a one-off conference in Las Vegas in 2009, that's turned into Security B-Sides, which has held under the banner 650 events in 12 years, 150 cities in 50 countries. Yeah. And I spend a lot of time doing that instead of product management, which is what Tenable hired me for. But it lets me do things like this, and it lets me meet people and help people find their path in the industry. And people bounce from product management into marketing. A lot of people don't like the tag marketing. If you watch things, there's a lot of discussion about the red team or offensive security versus blue team, which is defense. And then the more holistic thing is purple team, where we all work together nicely. And sometimes I joke that off and on through the years, because of the community building stuff I do, it requires budget. And so they put me under marketing off and on. And it's like, wow, in marketing, we have budget. I don't want to scare you guys that work for a living and as system administrators, but over here we have budget. I don't, for the record. I spend most of my time reporting to one of the founders or executives. I'm literally an asterisk on the org chart because nobody knows what to do with me. But
that's very
it's pretty
cool.
Good if you can get it. So I really appreciate y'all joining this evening, and don't be shy if you've got questions now or later.
Yeah. Jack, thank you again for accepting our invitation. Yeah. It's greatly appreciated. And again, everybody, as Ted said, remember that it's not because there's a vulnerability that you need to patch it. You need to determine if the system can be patched safely, okay? Remember that, it's important.
Yeah, that's, I've broken stuff. As I mentioned, my old printer here, when it gets scanned, if I forget to blacklist it, it spits out a stack of paper, and on the top page, there's one sheet with just the word help on it. And when I run automated scans and when I used to travel, I would come home and my printer would have printed out the word help, and it was a little creepy. I've seen those movies. They don't end happy.
All right. Thank you. How do you scan a brocade switch?
I have no idea. I know that this is not a knock on brocade, but I know you have to be really careful with the tools you use and make sure your scanners are fully up to date. For those of us that were around for Heartbleed, brocade was one of the components that fell over when a lot of the scans trying to detect Heartbleed. So did ILO, HP's Integrated Lights Out Management Platform. It's not fun to knock systems over. And I really don't know about brocade. That's something I might be able to dig in if you ping me and remind me. But there are some systems that are a lot more fragile than others. And unfortunately, that's worth mentioning. HP, if you've got older HP hardware, or even stuff that's not that old that runs ILO, which is great remote management hardware, the older versions are prone to the web interface going away during an aggressive scan. And it doesn't turn the computer off, but it means that you can't remotely manage the device. And there was a global bank that put people in airplanes to fly around the world in the pre-cloud days because they had to literally pull power cords because they didn't test before they rolled out a scan to scan their entire global infrastructure. Scans, we try to be very careful. If you go into Nessus and uncheck the safety, if you take the training wheels off, we will make your printers empty the paper trays. We will make some of your older and unpatched hardware fall over. Things like network connected multifunction scanners, your big printer scanner, photocopier, fax machine things. They're better now, but they've traditionally been notoriously vulnerable. And don't break stuff. That's a real concern.
Thank you for answering my question. Again, Jack, thank you very much. Jim Burton, would you like to conclude this?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today. And just so you know, we convert these recordings to podcasts. We have a podcast website that we host all of the previous speakers. And so we will be posted out there if you don't mind. I will post your photo and your bio there as well. And I'll send you that link if you want to see that. I also send out a feedback survey in a couple of days. So I'll send you any results we get from that. But we absolutely appreciate your time. And I think it was very interesting. I think it's very relevant.
All right, thank you.
A lot of our students are probably going to be hitting your website pretty quickly here, accessing the tool. So much.
All right.
Everyone have a great evening. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. I'll post the recording soon.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great night. Thank you so much. Bye, folks.